and speak and went to have tea with my mother. "Don't worry, they'll come to terms," my mother assured Elise. "Men like to argue." Elise's skin had burned during our excursion to the beach. She was flushed and overheated and soon excused herself, saying she had never been as tired in her life. As soon as Elise went to lie down, my mother grabbed my arm and whispered, "She's been here, uninvited." It took a while before I understood who she was talking about. Justine. I went through the courtyard to Mr. Enrique's house. He was sitting outside, still dressed in the black suit he wore at the store. "Is she here?"
"I don't get involved in these things."
He looked away. Therefore, I knew the answer was yes. I went inside and there was Justine and Liddy sitting in the dark. The shutters were closed and only the last of the day's yellow light came through in bands. Justine was in her best dress. She wore laced boots and her hair was braided and pinned up. Liddy was beside her, quiet, her hands folded on her lap. When she looked at me, I could tell she was alarmed. Justine, on the other hand, was furious.
"You didn't think you should take it upon yourself to tell me that he had a wife?"
"I was going to," I said. "But I hadn't wanted to face her." "I suppose you were too busy. Well, don't worry, I found out."
"Don't you think Liddy should meet him?
A daughter should see her father at least once in her lifetime." I asked Liddy to wait outside with Mr. Enrique while we spoke. "You came to see his wife," I said when the little girl had gone. "It won't lead to your happiness."
"What do I care about her?" Justine made a face. "Liddy is his daughter. He should know her."
"You cared enough to spy on us."
"Because you didn't even tell me he was back. You seem to care more for her than you do for me."
Justine's voice broke.
"Is she your sister now?"
"She's nothing to me," I said. It was the truth. Elise had been an amusement, nothing more. I suspected the same was true for Aaron. "And she should be nothing to you."
"I saw her fall on the road when she got off the ship and you assisted her."
"She needed a cold bath with her own soap from Paris.
It didn't help her from being ugly."
We laughed at that. Elise wasn't ugly. But she certainly wasn't beautiful, like Justine. "I came to show him his daughter, and that is what I still intend to do. He says he wants to see her."
"You've spoken to Aaron?"
Justine glared at me. "What do you think?" I begged her to reconsider, but she wouldn't listen. Perhaps I should have warned her that Elise was not as weak as she might appear to be. Justine led Liddy into our courtyard. All of the yellow birds that loved the sweet fruit in our garden so much, some people called them sugar birds, hushed when she appeared. There was a shadow at the upstairs window. I followed Justine so I might stand beside her. I'd been wrong and thoughtless to befriend Elise. My cousin had been gone for more than 5 years. "He won't come," I warned. "He will." Justine held tightly to her daughter's hand. Liddy looked over at her mother, confused. The last of the sunlight was in our eyes, but Justine refused to move into the shade. "How long do you intend to stand here?" I asked. "Don't you see him for who he is by now? Do you want Liddy to have to look into every man's face searching for herself? I have to see to this now before he's an ocean away and she never has the chance." My mother was the one at the window. She gazed down when she heard Justine, then promptly closed the shutters.
"You're locking me out?"
Justine shouted. I put a hand on her arm to hush her. "This won't work out the way you want it to."
"He'll see me."
Justine turned back to shout at the house, to my mother, I assumed, and to Aaron as well.
"I'm waiting for you to show yourself. You know she's your daughter."
Surely Aaron heard her raised voice. But instead of coming to face her, my cousin played the coward and sent his wife. I suspect he feared meeting up with Justine, and perhaps was most afraid of his own emotions. Elise came out in her rose silk dress. Justine was too dazed to say anything as she approached. "He asked if you would leave," Elise said.
"If I don't," Justine said,
What will you do then?
That won't happen, so we won't discuss it.
Elisa's eyes flitted down to Liddy, who still held her mother's hand.
Justine glared back, fiercely protective of her daughter.
Liddy wore her blue dress, beautifully smocked. She gazed wide-eyed at the woman from France, who clearly had the upper hand.
Is this the girl?
Elise focused her attention on Liddy entirely.
What a pretty dress you have.
You know who she is. Justine's chin jutted out. And so does he. Justine sounded strong, but I noticed her hands were shaking. For once I was glad I had never been in love.
This is Lydia, I told Elise. May I?
Elise was clearly entranced by the child. Justine was so taken by surprise, she didn't stop Elise from questioning Lydia about her education at the Moravian school.
I'm going to learn four languages, Liddy said. I already speak Danish, and soon I'll study German and English and Spanish.
What about French?
Elise smiled with a warmth I hadn't seen before.
Do you study that as well?
I'm speaking to you in French, madame.
Elise laughed, delighted. That was when I felt the chill go through me. Elise turned to Justine, cool but not unfriendly now.
Let me see what I can do. I'll speak to my husband.
When Elise went inside, Justine seemed shaken.
Who does she think she is to say my husband to me?
That's who he is to her. I don't think Justine had truly realized Aaron now possessed a life beyond what they'd once had together. We left the garden and went to my house. Since Aaron and Elise had arrived, I'd been so caught up with them I'd hardly been home. My children greeted me and hugged me, then ran off to play with Liddy. Rosalie came out to the porch and threw me a look.
Do you still live here? Or did you move back in with your mother?
I was trying to be polite to our guests, I said.
Don't be. Stay at home.
Justine was quiet during this interchange. But when Rosalie went to keep watch over the children, Justine turned to me.
You were right. I was a fool to go there.
She took my hand. She feared Elise's pleasantries had been a deception.
Don't let them do anything to me.
They wouldn't, I assured her. There's nothing they can do to you. I truly believed that at the time. There were green frogs in the garden, and the children were set on catching them with a net. We could hear them whooping, then gathering together to examine their catch. It was a near-perfect night, but beside me my dearest friend was crying. When I saw my husband later in the evening, he told me that Aaron was so angry to learn that my father hadn't left him any part of his estate that he'd already made arrangements to return to Paris. There had been threats and arguments at the store that were humiliating. My cousin's insolence drove him forward. He insisted he would take legal action. I worried for my husband's safety.
There's no need to worry, Isaac assured me. He realized it would be worth his while to leave.
My husband was clearly relieved that Aaron was preparing to go.
Your father made a wise choice. We'll all do well to be rid of him.
But we weren't rid of him so quickly that I didn't see him walking down the road toward the harbor. It was dusk, the hour when it was possible to do as one wished as darkness fell. Yet the sky was still bright in the east, and I knew where he was going. He went there every night, and waited outside the house on stilts, and nothing could be done to send him away. He had come halfway around the world, after all, and found what he wanted here on our island. The maids in my mother's house told me that my cousin was leaving in a matter of days. This time there would be no packet of lavender, no cause to call him back. I had gone to the store and looked through the ledgers my father had taught me to read. I found what I had suspected. Aaron was being paid off handsomely, so that he would let go of the business without further argument. I'd kept away from my mother's house after the scene in the garden, not wishing to see Aaron or his wife. But on the afternoon before they were to leave, Elise arrived at my house. I was on the porch mending my children's clothes. Their trousers and shifts always seemed torn after a day of play. I liked to sew, for my own relaxation, to clear the thoughts in my head.
The last thing I expected was company. Elise was wearing one of her beautiful dresses. Her hair was braided carefully.
You don't like us anymore, she said archly. You've disappeared.
I gazed at her and saw someone different from the girl who'd walked off the boat. She held a parasol to ward off the sun, but she seemed quite steely. She spoke to me as if I were a servant rather than a relative, however distant. When some chickens came pecking around, Elise kicked up dirt to drive them away. I suppose in Paris she did as she pleased and had everything she ever wanted.
He said we can take her, she told me.
I was confused. Was it Aaron's intention not only to live with his wife in Paris, but to have Justine as well? Many men did so here. Surely it must be the same in Paris. But such things were not spoken about, and certainly a wife would never announce that she was aware of that sort of arrangement, even if she tacitly agreed. Why on earth would Aaron inform Elise of his plan, and why would she be the one to tell me? And you are fine with this? You don't mind taking Justine to Paris?
Justine? Elise laughed. It's the girl I want. She looks enough like me for people to think I'm her mother. It's the gold in her hair.
I was speechless, though she didn't seem to notice. She went on to announce that they had decided to take Liddy and raise her as their own. The girl was young enough so that in time she would forget Justine and this island and the house that was so close to the sea she could hear the tides as she slept. I listened as Elise went on at great length discussing her plans. The lycée for girls Liddy would enter, the dozens of dresses she would buy for her, the bedchamber that was larger than the house where she lived now. There would be horses, for Elise's parents had a home in the country, and hunting dogs, and dinners on Friday nights with Elise's family. I listened open-mouthed, unbelieving and silent, until she announced that Liddy's name would be changed to Lydia Casson Rodriguez. Casson was Elise's family name, and her father would be so delighted for his name to be carried on. Hearing that, I at last found my voice. Pardon me, but do you know who the father is? A man who made a mistake, but one who has legal rights. Now I understood. Elise intended to rewrite Liddy's history as she pleased.
He is the father, and I will be the mother.
Have your own daughter, I said harshly.
I can't.
Elise knew what she wanted, and she wasn't about to let a few words from me hurt her or change her tactics.
Put our proposal before your friend. Tell her of my plans. She will come to understand it is far better for her daughter to live with us in Paris.
I went to see Aaron, but he shouted that he didn't want to see me. When I wouldn't give up, he came into the hall in a rage. He'd been drinking and was unstable. Do you know what your wife is trying to do? I asked. Give my daughter a better life? Better than what? Being with her own mother? Rachel, you've never understood what the world is like, he told me. You've always thought I could do as I pleased, but that's never been true. Because you have no courage, I said. My cousin slapped me then. I was shocked, and so was he. I didn't mean that, he said. You know I didn't. I turned and ran. There was no talking to him. We'd put a spell on him to bring him back, but we'd done so without thinking of all that enchantment might do. He was a ruined person. He was crying in the hall. And the saddest thing to me was that I could see he loved Justine, and he wasn't going to do anything about it. I went down to the house on stilts, my heart beating fast. I thought of what Rosalie had told me, how loving someone too much could be dangerous, and how she'd been punished for her pride. When I reached the harbor, I noticed there were shingles missing on the cottage, which hadn't been painted in several years. Since Adele had passed on, things had fallen into disrepair. The same was true for my childhood house, which hadn't been the same since the death of my father. Justine was waiting for me on the steps. I could tell from her expression that she hadn't slept. She had been waiting for a message from my cousin, but a different one entirely. She wanted to hear him admit that he'd chosen the wrong woman and say he was coming back to her. I was reminded of the lavender Adele had placed into my cousin's luggage to bring him back to Justine. I wished I hadn't found it and hidden it there again after he'd discarded it. I wished he'd never returned. I told her what Elise had proposed. Justine said nothing, but she grew cold. "They're going to steal her," she said. Justine was a free woman, but her rights were limited. She had publicly declared that Aaron was the father of the child. Everyone in our household had heard her say so, including my mother, who would certainly act against her if given half the chance. Liddy was inside studying her lessons. Justine sat there weeping. "There's no way for me to fight them. You people always get what you want." I was stung. Even though I knew what she said was true. People of my faith had fewer rights than Europeans, but compared to Justine and Adele, we were part of the established order. "He's found me every night he's been here," Justine said. "I was good enough for that, but not good enough to be my own daughter's mother." Perhaps Elise had guessed, and this was part of her revenge. Justine went inside without saying another word. I peered through the window to watch as she gathered a few belongings into a basket, then grabbed Liddy by the hand. When they came back, they took the stairs two at a time. "He'll never find us now." Liddy tossed a frightened look back at me as her mother hurried her along. I began to trail them, but Justine turned around and snapped, "Don't you dare follow us. You treated that witch as if she were a sister. Now look what's happened. You're one of them." I stood alone in the road and watched Justine take her daughter into the mountains, where the mahogany trees were hundreds of years old, their bark made into the strongest medicine on the island. Adele had once brought me a tea made of this bark when I fell ill as a little girl. I remembered only a haze from that time. My skin was so hot, I felt that fire had been laid across my bed. I felt a wave of that heat now, and my heart sank. I feared there was no way to protect Justine from my cousin's wife. In the morning, our visitors were standing in our courtyard while their trunks were brought down. They waited, exchanging glances. "Justine won't bring Liddy to you, if that's what you're thinking," I said.
"I don't suppose we'll see each other again."
Elise kissed me goodbye. I recoiled and wished her away. My cousin looked sad and somehow resolved. He leaned close so he could whisper to me.
"We made a mistake to think we could have what we wanted."
"Her mistake was you." She should never have trusted him or thought he would marry her. She should have stayed away from our courtyard. I watched them leave our garden. My mother was so distraught she had gone to her room. Despite my cousin's failures, she still had a deep attachment to him. I think she would have been pleased if he had chosen to stay. She might even have supported him. But of course, Elise had more to offer. Once they were on the street, I heard Elise's bright voice echo and I was puzzled. I couldn't understand why she was so cheerful when she hadn't gotten what she wanted. I heard a burst of her laughter, and she said the name Lydia in a loving way, and then went on to discuss how she had written the maids at home so the girls' room would be ready for her. All at once I knew she hadn't lost. I ran after them to the docks. I stood on the wharf, sunlight and tears clouding my eyes. I could see the rowboat of passengers that Elise and Aaron were joining, a little girl among those waiting. My cousin had hired some local men to search for Justine. They'd found her and restrained her until they could get Liddy away from her. The child was told that her journey was a brief trip to France, one her mother had approved. So why had her mother been sobbing when they came for them in the mountains? And why had she refused to let go of her daughter until she was held back by men who had left bruises on her arms? Liddy asked, but these questions went unanswered. The men who'd been hired to bring the child to the wharf were sailors who cared nothing for the people of our island. Justine might never have been discovered, but I knew the secret places in the hills. I ran until I heard a woman crying. It was up by the caves, where ruined women often went to end their lives when they had nothing left, near the gardens of the pirate wives.
The sailors who'd stolen Liddy had left Justine tied to a jacaranda tree. There were a dozen pelicans above her, each one perched on a higher branch. Some people believe that when a pelican cries, the tears shed are red as blood. They say the pelican will pluck the bloody feathers from its own breast to make a nest for its young despite the damage to itself. Justine screamed at me as I untied her.
You let them take her?
No, I said, but she wasn't listening to me. I broke all of my fingernails, frantic because she was crying.
Hurry, I have to follow them.
I knew the rowboat had left, the ship had boarded, but I stepped away once she was free and watched her run down the hill. I never knew a person to run so fast, to disappear the way ghosts do out of our line of vision. I heard that everyone fled the dock when she got there, that people could hear her crying for miles. No one saw Justine for several weeks afterward. She refused to answer her door, not to me and not to anyone else. I left baskets of food, but they went untouched. I sat on the stairs until evening, but she refused to come out. My husband did everything he could. He wrote to his family in France and explained the situation. A solicitor was hired, but in the end there was little anyone could do. The laws gave Aaron Rodriguez the right to his own daughter, especially once she was on French soil. My husband went on to find a second solicitor, one who was not above paying people off to get around the law. He took the high fee Isaac sent, but though he was well connected, he could not undo what had been done. I dreamed sometimes of Liddy on that ship, en route to Paris. In my dreams, she looked toward our island. A pelican followed her until she was halfway across the Atlantic, a place that was too cold and too far to reach, even for those who loved her best. Elise wrote me a single letter months after she'd returned to Paris. It was now summer. We hadn't heard anything of my cousin or Liddy, therefore I was shocked to find the envelope on my table. Elise had beautiful handwriting, and the ink she used was a shade of blue so dark it was almost purple. I thought about reading the letter. I held the brass letter opener and debated. But in the end, I didn't feel the message was meant for me. I brought the letter to Justine. She had avoided me all this time, and my loneliness was like a stone in my shoe. When I knocked on the door, Justine didn't look pleased to see me, but she let me in. I knew she put blame onto me, for I had befriended the witch from Paris. That much was true, and I regretted it every day. The house felt empty when I came inside. The windows were shuttered even though it was a beautiful day. The sea was green. "What is this supposed to be?" she said when I held out the letter. "Something from Paris." The envelope felt hot in my hands as if it had breath and life. "Would you rather I burned it?" She gestured for me to hand over the letter. Then she went into her bedroom. Whether or not she read what Elise wrote, I will never know. Perhaps she cursed its author. Perhaps she gave thanks for what little news she had of her daughter. When she came back, the letter was folded in half. Together, we burned it in a bowl Adele had once used to make elixirs, including the one that had saved my life. The sparks flew up. As they did, I made a wish, and this one came true. From then on, Justine answered the door when I came to call. One day, she was sitting in my garden, and I knew that she had forgiven me for having Aaron as my cousin and the witch from France as his wife, even though nothing was ever the same after that. Chapter 4. If You Leave. Charlotte Amalia St. Thomas, 1824. Rachel Palmier Petit. When I thought of the last moments of my husband's life, the sudden stab of pain he must have felt in his heart, the speed with which he slumped over his desk on a hot afternoon, the lemon-colored sunlight falling across his shoulders, I wondered if he cried out for me, or if he had called to Esther, his beloved first wife. I hope she was standing there waiting for him, her arms outstretched to hold him,
and that his spirit lifted itself out of his body with joy. On the night my husband died, I came home from the office alone with his spectacles and his watch. I got into our bed and waited for the spirit of the first Madame Petite to lie down beside me and mourn with me, but she was gone. She had been there for only one reason, to watch over her husband. Now he belonged to her in the world beyond ours. His was the third death, and the one that changed my life more than any other. Isaac was only 50, and his death came as a complete surprise. I was just 29, too young to be a widow. I went to Justine and asked her to make me a black dress, for I would have to wear black for the next year. She knew I didn't love Isaac, but he was my husband all the same, the father of my children. She understood my fear. I was still young, and I was responsible for 6 children, all of whom had experienced loss. The day of my husband's funeral was hot, the kind of weather that made people faint. It was a blur to me, and I was glad when it was over. At last dusk had fallen, and the children were asleep. David, Samuel, Hannah, Joseph, Emma, and the youngest, always called by her French name, Delphine. Rosalie dozed in a chair in the nursery. I still hadn't told her that tomorrow we would be forced to leave. We could no longer afford this big house, and it would eventually be sold. In the past months, the business had been failing, and it was possible that we might have to close the store, our last real asset. I dreaded Rosalie's reaction. She had lived at this address longer than I had, and was already here working for Isaac when the first Madame Petite arrived from France, limp from the heat, her freckled face flushed with exhaustion, her luggage so heavy 4 men had to carry her trunks from the dock. Madame's dresses from France were still in the cabinet. I intended to sell them with the household goods, though it caused me pain to do so. On the last evening I would ever spend in my husband's house, I felt a struggle within me. I was free, unmarried, but I was also trapped. This was the moment when I'd always imagined I could begin a new life. Now I wasn't so sure. The green shutters at the windows were open, and the breeze came spilling through the house. The cool stone corridors were empty, for the mahogany furniture Rosalie oiled every other week would soon be sold at auction and had already been collected in a horse-drawn cart. Adele had cautioned me before I married that the Petite family would know only tragedy, but she'd never warned me how much I would love my children, both those I gave birth to and those I had inherited, or how that love would imprison me. In the fading light, it was still so stifling that sparks of heat rose into the pockets of darkness. As I walked across the courtyard, I noticed that parrots came to the stone fountain to drink. Though it was good luck to see them, especially in your own garden, this would not be my garden anymore. At the funeral, people had held wet handkerchiefs to their overheated foreheads. I'd had the sense that I was in a dream as it was happening, and that in my true life I was in my bed in Paris, under cold linen sheets pressed with lavender water, and that the rain was pouring down on the slate roof as I slept. Surely it was only in my dreams that I was a widow with too many children, and that I did not shed a tear as others wept around me. I returned to the cemetery after the children had been comforted and had their supper, this time alone, so that I might leave branches of the flamboyant tree on Esther's grave. Her grave and Isaac's were next to each other. Husband and wife had been written on her headstone in Hebrew, and there had always been a space for him. The branches I brought were only sticks, but the fragrance of the wood was sweet. I wandered through the paths, looking for spirits and finding only still, heavy air. On my way out of the cemetery, I heard the gravedigger say the flowers had bloomed all at once, as if they were growing on the hillside in the season where everything turns red. I turned and saw it was true. That was how I knew my gift had been received. It is foolish to cry over things you cannot change, yet on my last night in the Petite house I did exactly that, as I looped a rope around the donkey's neck to lead him from the barn my husband and sons had built for him. The donkeys on the island may have been nasty things, but not this one. This one trusted me, and that is why I wept. I was not trustworthy.
Later I would tell the children that Jean-Francois ran away and vow I could not hold him back. I had told them this once before, on the first day he came to us, but the donkey had returned of his own accord. This time I intended to bring him far into the mountains. He wouldn't find his way back now. We could no longer afford to feed him, and there wouldn't be a stable once we moved into town. There were clouds of mosquitoes at this hour, so I slipped a white shawl over my head. The fevers here were deadly. Yellow fever, malaria, illnesses few survived. I had reason to live. 6 of them. On nights like these, I always made sure there was netting over the children's beds. They would cry tomorrow when they went out to the stable, even the oldest David, who was nearly a man. He was as tall as his father had been, and he would turn his back to me so I wouldn't see his tears. But he would miss Jean-Francois as much as anyone. After Isaac's death, I'd gathered the frightened children and assured them that it was God's will to release men from pain. Their father was gone from this world, but he would always be with them. That was what love did. It kept a person close. We covered the mirrors and tacked black fabric over the windows. I had thought I would have to get rid of the donkey by myself, but when I stepped into the yard, Justine was waiting for me. She had forgiven me, but there was a distance we hadn't known before, caused by Liddy's absence. As girls, we had imagined we were one spirit divided into two forms. Now, we kept things from each other, especially when it came to sorrow. We never spoke Justine's daughter's name aloud. The word brought too much grief. The air was spicy with the scent of bay trees as we walked together, leading poor Jean-Francois along. Bats hung from the branches like black leaves. As girls, we had always come to this mountainside to make plans for what we would do when we were women. We used to think women our age were growing old, yet on nights such as this, I felt the same as I had when we were 16. "You should have gotten rid of him the first night," Justine said of Jean-Francois, who balked as he was led away from home. "Now you're crying like he's your baby." "You take him," I suggested. We still like to argue like sisters. "He'll follow you as well as me. You could put up a barn beside your house. And feed him what? Oh no, I can't have a pet." "He should have stayed wild. You should have never spoiled him." Before long, Justine and I had walked so far the moon was hidden. We were both deep in thought. We thought of the men we loved and the men we didn't. Though we didn't speak, our breathing was in the same rhythm. We let the donkey go on the dark road. He stood where he was, confused. Then he came up to me and nudged me. I did not shed a tear at my husband's funeral, though he was a good and decent man, but now I wept openly, sobbing, and I could not stop. Justine slapped the donkey on his rear to force him to trot away. Still, he looked back. He did not want to leave me. Who would give him bread soaked with milk as a treat? Who would brush the dust from his coat? I didn't believe I could love anyone, and yet I was in tears. I was as alone as that poor motherless creature. Then and there, I thought of all the things a woman could do to escape her life. She could walk into the water and see nothing but blue, hear nothing but the rising tide. She could leap into a ravine where the parrots were hidden in the leaves. She could climb onto a boat in the harbor, cover herself with a muslin tarp, eat limes until her journey was over. Justine and I could make our way to France. I could leave my children until I was able to send for them. Surely they would receive the blessings of our congregation, even though I had little to do with the sisterhood. I could buy the tickets, pack a suitcase, wait for Justine outside her house. But there on the dark road, I felt a kick inside me, the spark of life. I had kept to myself what I knew to be true. There was a baby to come. I had known for some time, but I told no one, not even my husband. I had already decided to name him Isaac in honor of his father, the man I could not bring myself to love. The baby had been inside me for 6 months, but I wore bigger clothes and ate less. Waiting for the third loss, I hadn't known who would live and who would die. Sorrow always comes in that number, and I had feared the child I carried might be taken. but instead it was Isaac. Tonight I told Justine about the baby. She hugged me and said all children were gifts from God, therefore God must believe I could carry this burden, even though I was alone. I remembered what Adele had told me, that I would love someone one day. But that day was not yesterday, and it wasn't today. It was the red season, when the twisting roads were covered with petals, as if a woman had cried blood suddenly, without warning, after her heart had been broken. We moved in with my mother. I wore black on that day and kept my eyes lowered. This was the last place I wanted to be, but I was a widow with 6 children and 1 still to come. I needed to practice logic and thrift. Most of our belongings had already been sold off to pay off Isaac's debts. Women were entitled to no earthly goods in this world, and when the will was finally read in the parlor of my mother's house, I was passed over for a male relation in France. No one heard of him before. No one had met him, but Isaac's family in France now owned most of the estate, including my father's store and house. We would be allowed to live off our smaller portion. A stranger would decide all our fates. Our situation did not surprise me. I was more shocked when the will was read to discover that Rosalie was not a maid but a slave, something my husband had kept from me. Perhaps he was embarrassed, as he should have been. He was a kind man, but he believed in the social order and his views were not mine. My father had freed Mr. Enrique before they reached this island. I begged Rosalie's forgiveness when I discovered the situation, yet again there was nothing I could do. Because I was a woman, I had no legal right. I could not change what had been written into the law. Once I'd moved into my mother's house, I attended services on Saturday mornings and sat among the women with my mother and her good friend Madame Halevy.
"You haven't been here for quite some time,"
Madame Halevy remarked. Nothing went unnoticed by her sharp eye. "I was mourning my husband," I said.
"As I once mourned mine, but I didn't forsake my God."
We stared at each other. Then I said, "I'm sure he will take that into consideration when you die."
"Which will be a very long time from now," Madame Halevy assured me.
I turned from both of them. Their lives had been built around our faith in our congregation, but I went to the synagogue only because I was expected to do so. When prayers were spoken, I didn't ask God for anything, nor did I beg for mercy. My life had returned to the one I'd had as a girl, only now I had 6 children depending on me. I was more trapped than ever. During the months that we waited for Isaac's relative to arrive and claim his property, I worked beside Rosalie at mealtime and in the laundry. There was a space between us now that I was aware of her situation, and we did not speak as freely as we had when we lived in my husband's house. There was endless work to be done, and I often was too tired to eat. Sometimes in the evening, I sat in the garden and thought of my dreams, and how they were further away now than they'd been when I wrote my stories in a notebook. I'd packed away my notebook. I was a disbeliever now. All the books in my father's library had been sold. I had managed to save a single volume, Perrault. But of late, I hadn't the heart to read those stories and imagine cold black nights in Paris and paths that might lead through the woods outside the city where the old chateaus could be found. My oldest daughter Hannah often came to sit with me as if she could sense my despair. She was 9 years old, but wise beyond her years. She had always helped me take care of the younger children, who were a little troop always together. Although she was not my daughter by blood, she understood me, and she slipped her hand into mine when she took note of my despair. I stroked her hair and was glad she had an open heart and was nothing like me. She asked me for a story, for I often read to her from my notebook, but I said I didn't believe in such things anymore.
"You do," Hannah insisted.
I went searching for my notebook. It was in the kitchen, stored with Madame Petit's cookbooks. From then on, I kept it in my bedchamber. I never lost sight of it again. I wrote in the evenings, and whenever I could, I went to speak to the women in the market. "Tell me a story," I would say to them,
as if I were a child again, and they would sit beside me near the crates of chicken or the piles of fish and describe the wonders of our world. Late in the afternoons, I visited the cemetery. On most days it was so hot steam rose from the puddles after the rain. A simple walk and I was soaking wet. At the gate I slipped off my dress and wore my white muslin petticoat. I wanted to be the girl I used to be, to go backward in time so I might sit in the mountains and watch for parrots and believe my whole life was ahead of me. I brought branches of flamboyant flowers to place on the graves of Isaac and Esther, and the bees drifted above me, rumbling through the air. Esther's ghost had never again visited me. She must have been satisfied to have her husband back in her arms. Beside their graves, there were ground doves nesting in the weave of oleander, calling to each other. Perhaps they were in love, as Esther and Isaac had been. Although I'd never loved my husband, I missed him. My milk was still in from the baby before the one I carried now. Perhaps I should have been more modest, but I didn't care. I was too hot to wear anything more than my petticoat. Sometimes I wondered what I did care about. Rosalie was the one who went to my children when they cried at night. Their cries were so distant when I was asleep that I barely recognized them. I thought perhaps I was becoming more like my mother than I'd ever imagined I could be, cold and far away. I missed the three people who had died, and I thought perhaps I myself would be better off dead. I lay down on the soft earth of the cemetery and imagined what it might be like, even though I knew such thoughts weren't good for the baby I carried. Perhaps inside me he was crying too. People began to notice me in the place of the dead, there in my white undergarments lying on my back and studying the leaves and the treetops where ghosts walked. The old men who came to pray in their black hats and prayer shawls ran away when they spied me. They covered their eyes and asked God to protect them. My mother soon heard the rumors about me. She called me to her.
"People are starting to talk about you."
She had developed a cough. Ever since the death of my father, she had seemed weaker, but only in her physical aspect. Her tongue was still just as sharp.
"They think you're going mad, or that you're possessed.
You think you're the only one to know grief? You think I didn't lose more than my share?
Cry all you want at night when you're alone in bed," my mother advised, "but compose yourself when you go out."
Other than my undergarments, the only clothing I'd worn since the funeral was the black dress Justine had sewn for me. It was filthy. When I finally gave my mourning dress to the day woman who came to help us with the wash, the water in the tub turned black. Burrs and sticks rose to the surface, for they'd stuck to the hem of my garment. Rosalie cried when we left our house. She had good reason to do so. My mother was horrible to live with, and ordered her around so that she had double the work, as well as the children to look after. Rosalie had begun to spend time out behind our house, where Mr. Enrique lived. She was younger than he by 20 years, nearly the same difference as that between me and my husband. Still, he seemed like a young man whenever Rosalie came around. As for her, she sang to herself even when we did the laundry together. I knew love when I saw it, from the flattering white dress she wore to the cakes she baked for him, to the sound of their laughter as they sat together outside his cottage. One night I waited for her to see if I was correct. I was there when she came into the courtyard. She was aglow, singing a song I didn't recognize in a language I didn't know. I admired Mr. Enrique, the man who had saved my father's life. I'd given him all of my father's clothes and personal belongings before my mother could stop me. He was a solitary man, but he didn't always spend his time alone. I warned Rosalie that she was not the first woman to want him and that he didn't seem to want a wife. "It doesn't matter. I'm the best," Rosalie assured me. I suppose this is what love can do to a woman. Bring her into a garden at night, convinced she somehow can affect fate's plan with her desire. Love like this was a mystery to me. I didn't understand how people allowed sheer emotion to get the better of them. You couldn't see love or touch it or taste it, yet it could destroy you
and leave you in the dark chasing after your own destiny. My son came when the weather changed during the storms. The day began with a blue light, but ended with rain and wind. I shivered in my bed. When I was sure it was the baby's time, I begged Rosalie to get Justine. My friend arrived quickly. She and my mother did not look at each other or speak. It was the first time they had contact since Aaron was sent to Paris, but there were no arguments, for it was business on this night, the work of bringing a child to life. My mother didn't dare to keep Justine from our house. As she herself had never helped in a birth, I suppose she was grateful to have a more experienced woman there. When the hard pains came, my mother left my chamber. She said a verse from Isaiah as she departed to keep Lilith away, granting the screech owl demon peace if she would stay away. At least she'd said a prayer for me, which was more than I had expected from her. It took 4 hours to bring the last of Isaac's sons into the world. I swallowed my screams in my agony, but my bitterness grew. I felt it taking root in me right beside my child, a seed that was growing greener. I bit my lips until they bled and tried to fly out of my body to escape the agony of birth. When I thought I might die, I screamed out for Isaac's first wife to take me with her. Just when I was ready to go to her, the baby arrived. He was small, but he howled like a wolf as soon as he was born, the sign of a strong constitution. Justine wrapped him in a clean blanket and murmured a prayer under her breath, the one her mother used to say when we were ill or in need, in a language spoken in a world so far away Justine didn't understand the meaning of the words. All the same, we both knew it was a plea for long life in this cruel and beautiful world. It was a relief to give birth to this child, and I was grateful for the sleep I could now have. I thought perhaps my mother would now drop her antagonism toward Justine and show her the gratitude she deserved for bringing her new grandchild into the world. But I heard them talking out in the garden while I was dozing one afternoon, and my mother was not offering words of thanks. Their voices were rising and falling, and some of the words carried the sting of bees. Beside me, the last child I would have with Isaac was sleeping deeply, his breath even. I left him curled up and went to the open window. "I don't want you here again," my mother said to Justine. "I could have you arrested if I wished." Justine laughed.
"For what? Thievery? I was the one who was robbed. My daughter was taken by that witch, your daughter-in-law."
"You were the first to steal from me," Madame Pommier cried.
"What did I steal?" Justine said.
And then she was silent. She knew. There were tears streaking my mother's face. "Aaron." My mother shoved a strand of pearls into Justine's hands. They were the ones she had sewn into the hem of her dress when she'd fled Saint-Domingue. "Take them. They're yours as long as I never see you again."
"Of course."
Justine looped the pearls around her throat. "I'll take the payment for your sins, but that doesn't change anything, madame. We both lost our children because of you." Once the baby was settled, I began to go to the office. I had already discussed the situation with Mr. Enrique. I thought we could see to it that the business remained in our hands and keep the family from France at a distance. My father had taught me most of what I needed to know, and Mr. Enrique would see to the rest. We worked well together, and I quickly understood that the business was on shaky ground. Once more, we were victims of the weather. In the seasons of storms, we had lost both ships and merchandise. Mr. Enrique's suggestion was that we sell what was left of the shipping business, the province of my husband, and return to sales, my father's original endeavor, and his best asset, the store.
"Let other people run the bigger risk and earn the bigger profit. The store will provide steady income.
It's safer for a woman alone with a family to care for." I thought he was wise and let him draw up the figures. Then I presented the plan to my mother. The very idea of sitting down with her made the rash that had disappeared once my baby was born rise again across my skin. Still, like it or not, it had to be done. My mother and I were the family now, the two of us,
and perhaps we could agree upon a plan that would help us maintain some say over all the property that had once belonged to my father. We met in my father's study. Surrounded by his empty shelves, I felt my grief over his loss all over again. I thought of the night he came to tell me I would be married, and the satisfaction I'd felt in rescuing our family from disaster. But my husband was clearly drawn to bad fortune, as Adele had warned. Tragedy had followed him. When he combined his business with ours, instead of strengthening both, he'd brought it all down, unwise in ways of commerce and of the dangers of the weather. The pride I'd once felt for saving my father's business by agreeing to wed Isaac was a false pride. The marriage had been for nothing. But perhaps, now, I could truly rescue us, when I presented my mother with a plan that would make the business smaller but more reliable. She glanced at the ledgers and figures, then waved her hand, impatient.
You don't think the business will be entrusted to you and Enrique, do you?
We work well together, so yes, it makes sense. My mother's expression was sour.
You could never accept the fact that you were a woman and nothing more. I knew that when I was carrying you. You would cause trouble.
I'm sorry you feel that way, I said, even though I wasn't sorry at all. I was glad to have caused her trouble. My mother stood up away from the desk. The meeting was over.
Your husband's family is sending his nephew from Paris. What happens next will be his decision.
I stood as well. I didn't think she could tell I was shaking. I wouldn't have wanted her to know. You prefer a man you don't know to your own daughter.
It's the legal system that prefers such things, not I, my mother reminded me. I did not inherit anything, and neither will you. But you think you're above the rules, and you can do as you please. Be sure that's not what you teach your children.
I could not bring myself to tell Mr. Enrique that our plan had been overruled, but he knew. Everyone knew my husband's nephew was coming. Mr. Enrique continued to see to the business, but I took to my bed. I felt a fever come over me, a jade-green fever in my heart and my bones. My bitterness, inherited from my mother. I was so ill that my mother did not protest when Rosalie called Justine to visit me. Justine defied my mother and came to give me ginger tea, but it was not the cure I needed. I noticed she was wearing the pearls, and she laid them on my chest. They were as cold as ice. I could focus once more. Justine said the fever was inside my mind. It was true. A black curtain had come down ever since I'd moved into my mother's house. The edges of the pink flowers on the vines at the window were blocked out by wooden shutters. I could not see anything that was beautiful. My mother came to the doorway, a shadow. She had worn black ever since my father died. I looked at her and felt I was looking into a mirror. We resembled each other too much.
You're not to come here again, she said to Justine.
Then she turned to me.
If you don't intend to die, you'd better get out of bed.
When she left, Justine and I looked at each other and broke into laughter. So much for compassion.
You would have never traded places with me, I said.
Justine agreed with a nod.
Not for a day.
Justine took up her satchel and brought out a gift she'd made for me, a pale green dress. It looked so fresh, like grass and new leaves. When you're ready to give up your mourning, it will be here. Then you'll show your mother you're not afraid to be who you are. I would have liked to close my eyes and go on sleeping, but I had children, 7 of them. I did what I must, but I did so as a sleepwalker, still in mourning clothes. I was not ready for the green dress. All the same, something had changed inside me. I had one goal in mind, to escape my mother's house. One afternoon I went to the store to pick up some sugar and flour for Rosalie, and Mr. Enrique signaled me to follow him. There was a staircase that led upstairs. I had remembered the area as a storeroom when we had an overabundance of goods, but now our merchandise had dwindled to a bare minimum and the rooms revealed themselves to be lodgings. There were several bedchambers and a kitchen with an old stove left behind by the previous owners. We could rent this out, Mr. Enrique said. He had some of the workmen clean the place up and collect some unused furniture too old to sell. Or perhaps you have an idea for this place?
I grinned. Mr. Enrique had saved me, as he'd once rescued my father. I'll take it. I opened the shutters, and light spilled in. I could see the street and some vendors outside selling fruit.
What will she have to say about it?
Mr. Enrique asked archly.
She can say what she likes. It's up to the stranger from France to decide our fates. My mother has no more say than I do.
When I insisted we move into the rooms above the store, my mother didn't challenge me. Perhaps she was thankful to be rid of me. We had caused each other enough grief, and she had aged enormously. She was so ill that she spent her days in my father's chair. Often in the dusk, a neighbor would pass by and she would call out my father's name as if she'd seen him. Our new lodgings were crowded, and we didn't have enough furniture, but I preferred it. The younger children all shared a single room with mattresses on the floor. The older boys, David and Samuel, slept in what had once been a parlor, and we used the kitchen as our common room. I heard Mr. Enrique in the morning working in the office, setting out orders and keeping the ledgers. Rosalie often made him his tea. She stayed in his office for an hour or more, but I didn't complain. When my mother passed on, fully dressed, lying upon the bed she had shared with my father, no one was surprised. I sometimes think she willed her death. She was done with her life here and wanted nothing more than to join her husband. She left me her jewelry, the diamond earrings and brooch she'd slipped into the hem of her skirt, but everything else would belong to my husband's nephew when he came, including her house and all of her belongings. I sneaked in one night and took some of my father's maps of Paris, along with a silver pen he used. When I walked through my family's darkened house, I saw sparks in the palms of my hands, but when I tried to catch them, they vanished. If I'd ever been able to call spirits to me, that gift was lost to me now. In the garden, I thought I saw the lizard that had been Aaron's pet years earlier, there beneath the bushes where the leaves were so dry they sounded like paper rustling. As I was leaving, something held me back. I turned and went to uproot the apple tree from its large ceramic pot, then dragged it along with me. I left a trail of dirt behind me, and my arms were aching when I reached the little garden behind the store. I deposited the tree there for the boys to plant in the morning. In the days that followed, I accepted visitors who wished to pay their respects when they called on me with trays of food and sweets. I cannot say I felt true sorrow, and although I kept this to myself, my mother's closest friend, Madame Halévy, threw me a look when she and her maid brought us dinner, chicken curry and sweet molasses bread, and several mango and coconut pastries.
"Try to pretend you understand grief,"
Madame Halévy said in a pinched voice.
"You seem convinced you know so much more than I do," I responded ungraciously.
"Think back to this moment when you're my age,"
Madame Halévy told me.
"Then you'll know the answer."
I wrote to Aaron, and although I didn't expect the courtesy of a letter, a few weeks after my mother's death one arrived. He sent his regrets regarding her passing in a single line. "She was good to me when she didn't have to be." The remainder of his brief letter concerned Justine. I felt uncomfortable with the intimacy of his words. He missed her terribly, he wrote, and could not stomach his regret. In that way, my mother had ruined his life as well as mine. I stopped reading and brought the letter to Justine. I sat outside while she took his letter into her bedchamber. After a while, she came and joined me. I had glanced at enough of Aaron's missive to know he had written that their daughter was well cared for, as beautiful a child as she was intelligent. As if that message would lift Justine's despair. "Perhaps I acted wrongly," he had written, "but I acted out of love, so that she might have a better life." By now it was spring. It was the time when Justine and I used to wait for the turtles to come to shore, but she had no interest. She didn't care what happened on our island.
She looked toward France, where her heart and soul resided. When we met in the late afternoons, leaving the children in Rosalie's care, we often walked along the wharf. We watched the harbor, eyeing the ships as they came in, then we made our way home separately.